everyone. Welcome back to the Candid Podcast. We're just going to get right into it. The International Development Podcast for Catalyst McGill. I'm joined by my guest for today. Helia, would you like to introduce what you're studying and what your article's about?
Yep. So I'm Helia, and I'm in my fourth year at McGill now. I study political science and psychology. And the article I wrote is about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and more specifically, the Biden administration and their recent attack on Syria.
Okay. Yep. It was a very interesting article for sure. I'm just pulling up the questions. Sorry, I'm so like, I'm just super scattered. I'm just sitting here like, yeah, it's a very interesting article that you have that I haven't even.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay. So, all right, so let's start. So I kind of want, like, what is the concept of this lesser of two evils that you wrote about? What is that?
So this idea of lesser of two evils, it's really like this rhetoric that came about during the campaign period. So before, like, I think it was like as soon as Biden was announced as the Democratic nominee, people had this idea that, you know, we're settling for Biden because he's our only option. It's either Trump or Biden. So they were like, he's the lesser of two evils because we don't really have a good choice. It's just which one is not as bad as the other one. So that's pretty much the whole concept of the lesser of two evils.
Okay. Yeah. And do you think, yeah, it's I was gonna be like, do you think that's like socially related? But I mean, it is social, yeah. Socially motivated, like social activism.
Yeah,
for sure. So do you think that from this, so okay, well, let me ask you this question. Why is there a continuation of U.S. aggression towards the Middle East? Like, why have we considered Biden and Trump the representatives of like the same evil? So why is that?
So, the lesser of two evils was mostly with regards to like domestic issues, because it was coined by like progressives in the U.S. So obviously they care more about what's happening at home than they would like abroad, which is a fair assumption. And I guess the reason I didn't particularly agree with the phrase during like the campaign period because of like different reasons, but I guess the main firstly, I think it was, okay, I didn't agree with the phrase during the campaign period when it came to domestic issues or just having like domestic policy for the US, because I kind of saw it as an unfair comparison purely based on qualifications. You know, you're comparing Trump to someone who's like dedicated a life to public office, public service, both as just being in government and then as a vice president and now like running for the presidency. So I guess purely based on qualifications, it wasn't fair, if I thought at that time. And then also just having this idea of the lesser of two evils, it really is discouraging for political participation, which I think is very damaging, because obviously during a campaign period, you want people to be enthusiastic. You want them to take part in like fundraising or like having stuff organized for election day. So I think having that rhetoric really encourages a lack of political participation, because like, what's the point? You know, you're choosing from like the lesser of two evils, you know, it kind of makes you not want to vote as much. And we saw it like in 2016, where people were like, we're settling for Hillary Clinton. And then we saw the results of that. And then during the campaign period now as well. So when it comes to domestic foreign policy, I didn't really agree, because obviously Biden has changed a lot from the Trump administration. He's made strides domestically. He's like overturned and tried to like undo the damage that was done in the past 4 years. But when it comes to foreign policy, unfortunately, we saw like a month in that it's not really going to change. So I do now see that the lesser of two evils does kind of appeal to this foreign policy approach, because as you said, there's a continuation of foreign policy, regardless of the administration and regardless of who the sitting president is and who the party is, frankly, it doesn't really change much, as we've seen starting from like when the US first became the dominating power in the Middle East, which was what, like after World War II. So we've seen like years of this this continuation.
Just before we get into the, like, before we get into the foreign policy aspect of the U.S. government, I just wanted to ask you, do you think, like, because when people say the lesser of two evils, I think what they generally mean is, or like, Trump and Biden representing the same governmental structures that have caused domestic inequalities in the past and such. And so what do you think about that? What do you think of basically, because I recognize that, like, they're very different candidates, obviously. They're very different in their social aims. But I mean, Biden has been in government for such a long time, and not much on the social, like, justice front has changed. And I know there's, like, a renewed interest in making that change, but what, like, are your ideas going to be subject to change as Biden's presidency goes on, or are your ideas subject to change as Biden's presidency goes on the domestic front? Because at the end of the day, it is, like, the same system that they're representing. Yeah. So I think the calls are, like, to change the system. And yeah. I guess it's just a question. Do you think then that Biden is going to be, I completely just, like, went into the second question. I was like, well, here's the first question. But So scratch the first question. My new question is, do you think Biden will be able to live up to the expectations of being the, not the lesser of two evils, but completely but altering the system in a beneficial way for domestic policy?
That's a fair thing to say. I do see the point where the lesser of two evils is more so talking about the system, not, like, Biden in particular. So I guess my criticism was that, you know, you're weighing two different presidents. Where you know, I guess that notion of the lesser of two evils I saw was unfair. But for sure, when it comes to the whole system, it's hard to change. How do I say this? So I do see that how, like, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, like, if you're not striving towards doing, like, drastic change for the better, obviously, like, you're going to be labeled as a lesser of two evils, or, like, the, you know, the same, pretty much the same. So I don't necessarily see the, let me phrase this better. Give me a second.
That's all right.
I do think anything that's going to sort of strive towards, like, changing the system, I don't see it coming from Biden. I do see it coming from the Democrats currently in Congress who are fighting for, like, more progressive change. Mm. And I think that's where the idea of accountability comes in. So when you had a president like Trump, there was pretty much, like, no accountability for what he did or for what he said. But then when you have Biden, it kind of brings back this idea that you have to hold politicians accountable, even if they're doing good in one area. So, like, sure, like, Biden's doing a great job at combating the COVID-19, like, pandemic right now with, like, the mask mandate, which just ended, unfortunately, but, like, with everything that's happening with the vaccine rollout. But that doesn't mean we're disregarding everything he's not doing enough, you know. So it's the idea of that we can acknowledge the success that someone has had so far, but also hold them accountable. I don't think we can do one without the other without being unfair. So it's really, like, I guess the good thing about having, like someone like Biden in office is that it opens the possibility of holding your politicians accountable, whether it's from, like, Democrats or progressives in Congress, or, like, with people, with, you know, the general public. So I guess that's where I see, like, domestic change coming from, not particularly from Biden himself, but from people who are holding him accountable.
I really like that viewpoint of, like, accountability being the measure, that we measure our politicians in terms of being representative of a system, right? Like, I appreciate that viewpoint. I think that's a really good way of phrasing that. So speaking of accountability, what happened with Syria? Why, what was the motivation for that airstrike or what was the motivation for the airstrike without congressional approval?
Yeah. Well, I think it was the Pentagon who said, well, the reason for the strike was to, it was like a proportionate response to the bombing of Erbil International Airport, I think, a few days back. It was really just like to send a message that we will, the U.S. is going to protect their personnel and like do whatever, protect their interests in the area with whatever means possible, even if that means going back on like promises and, you know, having your first foreign policy approach be bombing Syria, which I guess, it, you know, sends a message of how the administration is going to continue this foreign policy approach, even though a few weeks back they were saying diplomacy, you know, just, yeah.
Do you think that this bombing is, because the way that a lot of like military and a lot of governmental personnel see it is the U.S. is holding a precarious position right now in the world order, kind of thrown off balance by Trump and other politicians. So do you see that, or I'm just thinking here. I'm trying to like ask. No, do you see this as a necessary, these type of measures as necessary for defending, American hegemony basically in the world? Do you see these types of measures as kind of necessary, or what do you think about maybe finding a different way?
Well, for like U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is pretty complicated. I don't think I can have an answer like in a 30-minute podcast. But I do think that the U.S. has like the biggest military in the world. You know, I don't really think one country or two countries in the Middle East can really put that national security at risk. You know what I mean? Like, because they have the biggest military in the world. They have the most presence in the Middle East or in other, in the Middle East as well. So I don't really see the aggressive approach as necessary when it comes to encouraging diplomacy and like peaceful talks. Does that make sense? Because it was, we already like saw it. Iran said they're not going to join the nuclear talks again. So we saw that this aggressive approach doesn't really fix anything. We also saw it with Trump. He also ordered an airstrike, and we didn't really see any like movement towards reaching peace. So it's really just history repeating itself and continuing the same aggressive approach, knowing it probably won't change much.
It's kind of like a cycle of,
yeah,
it's a cyclical thing, because the U.S. is now like, the U.S. is I understand why the U.S. takes violent actions in the Middle East in regards to maintaining their position, like, because it's very complex. You have other influences from Russia and China, but yeah, I think it's a brutal cyclical cycle in a lot of ways, and how it's not really getting anyone forward, and it's more keeping every nation kind of in place, and a lot of human suffering, which is a problem. So what do you think from your research would be a potential improvement for improving U.S. Middle East relations right now?
I do see how it's hard to change a system that's been in place for so long, you know, from like right after like World War II, this was the same U.S. foreign policy approach for the Middle East. So I do see how that's hard to change. But I guess my point with this article as well was that when you come to office with an idea to approach the Middle East with a humanitarian view, or like with a way that encourages peace and diplomacy, when you preach that in your campaign to get votes from like progressives, from whoever, I'm assuming you have a plan, you know, like, you're not just saying we'll get there and we'll see what happens. I'm assuming you come forth with a plan. So to say that and then to have the first action be an aggressive approach shows that, you know, maybe they haven't even considered the possibility of not having an aggressive approach to foreign policy in the Middle East.
I think sense? Biden's winging it.
You know, yeah, we're all just winging it as we go along.
Biden's in his office, like, send the bombs today. I don't know.
Buy us some time.
I don't really think I'd get this far. Yeah. Scratching the collar a bit. Do you think it would be different under Vice President Harris?
I don't think foreign policy is going to be much different. I really don't think so. I did think about this, you know, right after Biden was elected president, like what happens if, you know, someone else is in power, like Kamala Harris. So I do think maybe domestically things will change, because I think she does appeal to a population that's maybe a little bit more progressive than Biden. I don't think by that much, but maybe a bit. But with foreign policy, I think I tried to show that in my article as well. It's an issue that goes beyond your party. So whether it's Kamala Harris, whether it's Biden, whether it's the next Democratic president, there needs to be a change more drastic than just changing who's in charge what party is in charge to change the approach. So no, I don't think Kamala Harris coming to office is going to change much with regard to foreign policy in the Middle East.
Do you think that a change in what you're saying makes sense? There has to be a change in how we conduct how the United States conducts.
Yes.
Yeah, in Canada, we don't participate in these overseas atrocities. Just ones on our shores, anyway. At the indigenous communities, unfortunately. But anyway, like, what do you see? Okay, so I understand that it's going to take a long process of change for foreign policy for there to be an actual difference in negotiating and finding peace with a lot of countries in the Middle East. But do you think that it might be a little chaotic to do that change drastically under one administration? Because it would have to be, because the way that it's been visualized, Vox, I think, did a good like little infographic about this, is there's a very specific US centered world like defense system, especially around NATO, and that's already crumbling. And to have better relations in areas where the US is, where the US has to revamp the entire diplomacy system. So do you think that might be chaotic, or like, do you think that that revamp would be chaotic and it would have to be done over a period of time rather than the span of one presidency? Or do you think that if it is done in the span of one presidency, it could be beneficial?
I don't think it's an issue that can be solved over a span of like one presidency or, you know, So basically, like, where do you go from here? Like, what is the next kind of step?
What are the next steps, especially in such a precarious position that the world is in right now? Like, the balances of global power have really shifted, and it's going to be hard to figure out what's going to happen. What do you think about this?
I think it's not just. You see, I've had some time to think about this. I'm in my last semester, all like political science courses, especially like Middle Eastern politics courses, they end with the question, like, what is going to happen next? Like, whether it's like a particular conflict or a country, like, where do you see the end of this civil war or that? And I think what I've noticed is the general consensus in those courses is either, I don't know, they straight up just say it's too complicated to figure out, or we fail to see immediate change in a couple of years, or they say like there needs to be a drastic change. So, which is what I do agree with. I think there needs to be a drastic change, but not only to how the US approaches foreign policy, but also how they view the Middle East in general. So it's more so about changing the narrative you have about the region, which then can, and I don't think this is like overnight. Obviously, when you want to change your perspective, it's going to take a while. But then that can translate into change with a concrete change you can actually notice. So I noticed I think this was right after Trump ordered the strike during his presidency, where someone said, I really don't remember who this was, but someone said, I think it was on Fox News too, so it tells you all you need to know about where this is going. But they said something along the lines of, like, the Middle East has been at war for thousands of years. And I think they said something like the normal condition there is war, or something along those lines. And so this shows the narrative that the US has built around the Middle East. So, you know, it's this assertion that us having an aggressive approach is just another strike in a region that's already fighting. So, which is an insane assertion. Like, I don't think I'm out of line by saying war isn't, completely or should inaccurate. Never be, war should never be a normal condition of any.
No, and it's completely inaccurate. You know? And I've heard CNN, like, I've heard other narratives too by progressive media about how the Middle East needs basically like US fixing, pretty much. Like, we gotta, I mean, it is more fair. Like, we created these problems, now we have to fix them. But essentially, it's the Middle East needs. But then for the past, like, I don't know, like thousands of years, the Middle East has been literally the center of peace and science and prosperity throughout most of the world. Like, it's been arguably the most stable region for the past 1,000 years or so.
And if you go by that logic, like, Europe has been at war for thousands of years.
Europe, you know? Europe is messed up. They all hate each other. Like, there's so many because I'm doing a class on British mandate, like Palestine, and there are so many historical stereotypes of, like, the Arab people being aggressive and being always angry because of Islam influences. But at the end of the day, Europe is the one that has literally killed its population. So I'm sure the world wars were not in the Middle East. Last time I remember, they were in Europe, but Europe has been the most aggressive region for the past few. Sorry, that was my little history gene coming in. I was like, man, finally a chance to talk about what I'm studying. Jeez.
So that's exactly my point. Like, if you go by that logic, every U.S. foreign policy towards any country should be aggressive. You know, it's not. But I guess that shows the narrative that the U.S. has built around the Middle East. It's this idea that. And also, I guess this narrative feeds into the aggressive policy, because it's the idea that, okay, the U.S., like, will try to solve whatever issue we have with a Middle Eastern country peacefully, like, we'll try to solve it. But if that gets too hard, we can always just be aggressive, because the region is already at war, you know? So you need to just change this narrative. Like, you go beyond just seeing the region as trapped in the cycle of wars that you need to protect because you have national interests in the area. And, like, genuinely try to picture peace in the region for there to be a change. So this isn't a change that's going to happen overnight, but it's a step that needs to be taken.
I completely agree. And so on the topic of media, how much have you seen of media neglecting to mention Biden's actions kind of on both sides? Because personally, I've only seen a lot of outcry for what Biden's social media from other people around me and other people online. I haven't really seen
my article.
Yeah, and your article. I haven't really seen it on, like, any news outlet at all, and I'm sure it is, but it hasn't been as, like, prevalent. So do you think there's, like, a media neglect, or what do you think of that?
I do agree. I do think there's, like, a little bit, like, it's a disproportionate treatment in the media, but I guess personally for me, during the 4 years of Trump's presidency, like, whatever he did, just because of who he is as a person, I was like, of course, like, you know, like, it's, you know, it because of who he was as a person, everything, every decision he made did garner a lot of media attention, which I guess is fair. And then with Biden, it's kind of a different story, I guess. But I also do feel the reason for that is we are in kind of a hectic state. It's been a tough year. I don't think anyone can say this year hasn't been hard on them. So it is, to some extent, I guess the news of this kind of got muddled in with everything else that's happening. You know, every every day you see more COVID infections, you see more COVID deaths, you see lockdown extensions. So I think purely because of the state we're in right now, maybe that didn't get as much attention as it would have if we haven't been preoccupied with the pandemic. So I guess maybe that factors in.
It's like media desensitization.
Yeah.
Kind of that concept. Because last year, this exact same thing happened in Iran when Trump did that bombing. So yeah, it's crazy to think that a year ago, this would be top news, but now it's not so much. I was gonna say something, I can't remember it though. That's okay. I'm sure it'll come back to me. So what do you think of what do you think of the court of public opinion on this one? Think Biden's gonna get got, or what do you think? Do you think he's gonna get away scot-free out of this? Or do you think he's gonna be held accountable? What do you think?
It's hard to predict it. I guess he did get a lot of like criticism from the Middle East, like Syria, from Syrian officials, from Iranian officials. So I guess in that regard, like, I don't think he's gonna, you know, get away without any criticism. But what was kind of interesting to me was that there was Republican support for his decision to strike without congressional approval. Like, obviously at the beginning, the Congress was like, you know, you could have asked. Like, yeah. You know, but I did see like Republicans were supporting it. Like, is this the issue that's going to unite the parties? Like, they just get like rallying around bombing the Middle East. Like, but I found it really odd. Like, the Republicans, like, yes, this was an appropriate measure. This was, this was like proportionate or whatever. So I guess maybe maybe he will get away with it when it comes to like his like colleagues at home. So
I definitely think he's going to get away with it. I think if there's one thing Americans can agree on, it's attacking other countries. And that's a pretty big thing. They've done that for most of their history. So what do you think of other international in that line? What do you think of other international, like Canada? Do you think we should say something? I kind of think we should.
I think Canada needs to be saying something, yes, sure. But I also, I mean, America is a superpower. Like, what can you say? You know, like, I do see that. I do understand that.
We're going to say something.
But even if all of Europe says something, I'm sad to say, like, it doesn't really matter. The U.S. is still a superpower. You can say what you want, and you probably won't because, like, diplomacy or allies. Like, I don't think Canada is going to say anything because, you know, they're the biggest ally to the U.S. And I get it. Like, I don't blame them, but
I think we should. I think we should say something. I think it won't matter. I don't think the U.S. will be like, man, we should start listening to Canada more on our foreign policy. I don't think it'll matter as much, but I definitely think that it might be a source of reflection if enough countries say something. Like, hey, stop bombing other countries. We got economic interest there. We really don't appreciate it. Or even it's just not humanitarian. Like, it's not right to do, especially in the midst of this pandemic. But
yeah,
I mean.
But that's also again, like,
go for it.
No, but that's also like a sad reality. Like, if other countries do say maybe stop bombing the Middle East, you know, the first reason for saying it is going to be because we also have interest in the area, you know? It's definitely not going to be because, you know, we're just going to, we suddenly have humanitarian interest. But yeah, I guess that's also the sad reality.
It's honestly such a hard topic to even say. And I feel bad that I've been asking you these like super loaded questions. Like, what do you think we should do in the Middle East? Do you have the answer? Because I know that it's so hard. And like, there's our viewpoint of it as students, but then there's like the viewpoint of like people who work in government, people who work in the military, and they have completely different viewpoints on how they want to maintain peace. So it's so hard to actually like say, this is how you maintain peace. So I appreciate that you came on and willingly engaged in this conversation without
trying to solve world problems.
Trying to solve world problems.
We have to be fair too. Like, we're not in the position of like government officials, but just from our viewpoint, this is
Yeah, from our viewpoint,
yeah,
And it's not like it's a bad viewpoint to have. It's very reasonable, if the proper it's reasonable to say the Moon of Elise should not be Syria should not be bombed by a president who said he's not gonna bomb anymore, and peace should be like that's a pretty reasonable request to hold government accountable. So we'll really see if Biden does become the lesser of two evils, or if he becomes not evil.
I hope so. I do hope so. But well, that's we'll see. We have three something more years, right?
Yeah,
Let's see.
well, something like that. I don't
Oh.
know. I don't live in the U.S. I'm not a part of
Yeah.
this. I'm up here in the frigid cold. What state are you from? Are you from the U.S.?
No, I'm from Iran.
Oh,
Yeah,
are
just
you there now?
no, I'm in Toronto.
Oh,
Yeah,
you know
I'm
what I
not that
asked. You
far.
know what I
No,
meant. I wasn't like, oh, were you? I was like, what? Okay, so
yeah,
yeah,
no.
man. At the end of the day, we're up here. We don't have
Yeah.
to. We only have to worry about it so much at snow,
Yeah.
but it is terrible. I don't know. Canada should say something. We've been bullied enough in vaccine distribution. Now we're.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Anyway. All right. Well, I
It's a
think
whole
that's
other
a
conversation,
whole
but
other conversation. I don't even
yeah.
know why I went down that road. I was like, vaccines. So I think that's good for today. Is there anything you want to plug before you go? I usually edit in an ending, but I was like, no, not today. Today we'll do it live. So is there
Yeah.
anything you want to plug before you go?
No, I think that's it. I don't think there's
Right,
much
well,
else to say.
by God, check out Elia's article
I will,
on
yes.
Catalyst. Check it
Share
out.
it.
Share it. We'll include it. We'll include the link in it. Do you
Yeah.
have a like a Medium article or anything? Any Medium account that you want to plug?
No, sadly, it's just Catalyst.
Not a thing.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I wish you all the best with your studies and stuff. I can well, thank
Thank
you so much for coming on and engaging in this tough
you.
conversation about how to solve the
No
Middle East
worries.
from the
It
US's
was
perspective.
very fun.
Yeah, I'm glad you had fun. Well, thanks for coming on. And we'll see you guys later. I don't know. I don't usually end this. I usually like trail it off like a beat because I don't want to end.